Hello and welcome. Scare Track. Scare Track Podcast.
Welcome to the Scare Track Podcast, the UK's first podcast dedicated to the scare attraction and haunted house industry. However, please be advised that we have no censor. The language used may be of an explicit nature and is not intended for younger listeners or the easily offended. All views expressed are those of the individual host and do not necessarily reflect those of Scare Track, our guests, or any of our associates. So, if you're still here, let's get scared.
So this is where our adventure begins.
Oh my God!
I'm scared myself!
Kate Monroe is screaming.
Spoiler alert!
Freaking awesome.
The quality of the set was amazing.
Oh, I don't like it.
Hello and welcome to the Scare Track Podcast. My name is Mikey and today's episode is a very special episode because we have a Q&A session with Andrew Porter. That's right, you guys have sent in your questions for Andy from Firefly Creations. Now, in the past, Andy's created fantastic attractions, scares such as Slasher, Insomnia, Love Hurts, Soul Seekers, real fan favourites at Screamfest Burton. He's also been behind many attractions in theme parks as well, things like Croc Drop, things like the Gruffalo River Adventure. We've also got the Oblivion, the Black Hole. Honestly, Andy is a very, very talented man, and we're really lucky to have him back here on the Scare Track Podcast with a Q&A session. So without any further ado, let's welcome Andrew Porter back onto the Scare Track Podcast.
You're listening to Scare Track.
Hi folks, and welcome back to this episode of the Scare Track Podcast. Like I said in the intro, I am joined by Andrew Porter. Andy, how's it going, pal?
Good, thanks, Mikey. How's everything with you?
Yeah, all good, thank you. All good. Very excited to be able to hopefully explore more of the world now and get out and about as restrictions are lifting, and fingers crossed things are going in the right direction. Now, we spoke a few months ago all about Firefly and things you've done in the past as well. So guys, make sure you check out that interview, an awesome interview with Andrew Porter here on the Scare Track Podcast. Just click a few episodes back. But Andrew's been very kind to come back onto Scare Track and do a little bit of a Q&A with us. So first of all, thank you for letting us do this, Andy.
That's okay. I like to punish myself every now and again, so I thought I'd throw myself back into the fire, but allow people to ask me questions, which can either go one way or another, depending on who offends me.
you like to punish yourself, but you like to give a bit of fanfare. It's good. You give the fans what we want, and we've got a whole selection of questions here as well. So everyone that did send in a question for Andy, thank you so much, whether it is via email or over on our social media pages. If you've missed out this time, head over to our website where all the links to our social media pages are on there, scaretrack.co.uk. A few people sent in similar sort of questions, so I've sort of merged them together to collate a whole few, really. So shall we just go straight into it?
Let's go.
First question, one that was sent by Jack Rock. Jack, thank you. Is where do you draw inspiration from for your work?
Hey Jack, it's great to hear from you. I'm glad you put something in. You're probably the only one that's written in, so thank you very much.
No, there's more, I promise.
My inspiration, wow. Do you know what? I find life interesting. I know this sounds like a really strange way to start, but I'm fascinated by time and how humans have lived across time, and all of the things that's driven us from the early caveman all the way to now, because we're all the same. We've all got the same brains, we've got the same hearts, we've got the same lungs, and we're all kind of built the same, but we're all brought up by being influenced by different things. So how we were taught at school, or how we had weekends with our families, or the holidays that we went on, which then makes us all very unique people. Yes. So I'm fascinated by watching people, and it's something I've been very lucky to do while working on Screamfest, was really analyze how people talk to each other, how they spend time together. And then I travel a lot. I go to a lot of museums. I read a lot of history, watch a lot of documentaries. But then my mind starts to wonder, what's around that corner? You know, that guy looks a bit shady. He doesn't really fit in here. He's got different clothes on. He's going into that shop. But is that shop really a portal to another dimension? And he's a visitor here from another universe that we don't know. And sort of following him, where's that adventure going to take me? It gets a little bit odd. And I keep thinking about ways of stories that people end up in them. So when you watch a horror film, and I've always thought this when writing stories, people in horror films don't go, oh, I'm going to go into that door because I'm going to get murdered. Funnily enough, you know, they don't do that.
Surprisingly.
No, surprisingly, they don't do that. It's either a cursed item from a family member that lived in the 1800s who was part of some sort of ancient cult that when you read the book backwards for in some teenage party that opens up a portal to another realm and all of these weird, creepy monsters come into it. And then the rest of the film is either mutilating your friends to try and close the book.
Yes.
And that's how I approach my sort of stories. Everything from Soul Seekers, when I was a massive fan of Most Haunted. It was something I sat and watched with my mum on an evening, and we would watch Yvette Fielding and Carl run around these abandoned locations, and I was lucky enough to research that paranormal side as well. I was a skeptic at the time and I was fascinated by it. So I realize this question is going off on a tangent. They'll all do this, everyone. No. So sit back, buckle in, it's going to get weird. I was fortunate enough when I was going to Alton Towers a lot, I was animating an animatronic skull that I got in America, and I found a place called the Old Crown Inn, which is in a place called Waterhouses, about 10 minutes out of Alton. And I was helping those guys with their marketing to sell their bed and breakfast. Right. And they wanted to make some more money. I said, so we could do an event. And he goes, well, this place is haunted. And I said, look, I don't really believe in ghosts. And he was like, well, stay the night.
Right, okay.
And if you go on YouTube and you write in the Old Crown Inn EVP, you will see some very old footage, exclusive very old footage of me back in 2000 and I want to say 2007, 2008 of conducting paranormal investigations at this pub.
Wow, okay.
We got voices on tape. We had poltergeist activity. Flashlights would turn on and off on their own. There was intelligent knocking. You would ask questions and it would remember the answers. So we did that for 2 or 3 years while the current owners had the pub. Had some fascinating stuff there. So then it came to then writing Soul Seekers, where I loved the idea of this 1920s, 1930s. And a shout out to Sam Bott and Kate Munro here, who helped me get that thing built while I was in the depths of nocturnal painting concrete on wood for hours on end. And it was creating this storyline of the narcissism of reality television. That's kind of where it came from. I always try to put modern day stuff or political stuff into my horror attractions. Yes. And it was looking at reality television and how we were lied to about what we're seeing as reality, but it was so fake. So I wanted to do Soul Seekers, where we had this paranormal investigation where you get to be on Soul Seekers live television broadcast and everyone's invited to come and do this. You go into the hotel room, then you get sucked into this 1920s, 30s hotel with the music and find out that you get sucked into the past and your soul stays in the hotel forever. And that's kind of how that one came about. And I guess all of the work that I do is based on life experience, based on watching people live and just making up crazy stories about what I see.
Yeah. No, that's cool, though, because it adds that sort of an element of realism to start with. That's your stimulus. That's your stimuli. There's something real that you're either seeing or reading or watching or experiencing, and you've just basically created a world out of that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And all of them, they all had it, you know, everything from Slasher all the way up to my final one, Insomnia, in 2019.
Yeah. Crikey. That's it. I blooming love Insomnia. Awesome. No, that's perfect. And thank you to Jack for that question. And it's great. It just goes to show that, you know, no matter what sort of new task or new attraction that you're ready to design or create and whatnot, you can just... It could be from a book. It could be from an experience. It could be from a TV program. It could be from anything that you sort of get your... get your inspiration from, I guess, really.
I think the most important thing to do as designers is we've got to be always thinking about the guest. You know, at the end of the day, the end user of this is a guest. And the point of it is to make happy memories with their friends and families. That's my passion. That's what drives me. It's what's got me up in the morning ever since I was about 13, 14 years old, getting on a train and going to Alton Towers every weekend I possibly could, absorbing all of this stuff. You know, it started out with me being obsessed with roller coasters, but it kind of evolved quite quickly into me being obsessed by the atmosphere and the theming and the storytelling atmosphere of it.
Yes.
Only because of the great memories it was creating for the people that were going on there. And as any designer in this industry, their main goal is, what does the guest want? What are the stories we're telling? And how can we emotionally connect them to the stories that they go remembering it?
Definitely. And that's very similar to me, to the way I sort of, I don't want to say the word, grew up with theme parks as such, but it's right. You go there as an enthusiast about the coasters, but then that turns into the storytelling or the theme or even the colour or the soundtrack or anything. It just sort of it implodes into not just the sense of being on a coaster, but the sense of being within the area around the coaster, queuing up for it, the shop afterwards. It's just like you say, just thinking about the audience and thinking about the people going on these experiences or going through Insomnia. It's just the whole package, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think my, you know, when I really came to understand that is when, you know, as I kind of grew up going to theme parks and going on roller coasters, you know, 1998 was my year when I became absolutely obsessed with them. The year Oblivion opened, which was wonderful. Yeah. The very first project I did at Merlin Entertainment in 2014 was Oblivion at Gardaland.
Yeah, that's amazing.
You know, it was a wonderful synergy and life achievement for me to have been involved with.
Definitely.
But it's an interesting thing when you talk about enthusiasts. There are two types, is what I see. There's the roller coaster enthusiasts that just love everything to do with roller coaster. They would be more than happy going to a park and sitting on a roller coaster built over a car park because they love the roller coaster. Then you get the theme park enthusiasts who love everything to do with the roller coaster, but then the atmosphere, the theming around it. If you took Nemesis out of its pit and removed its alien, it would no way near...
You've just got a standard B&M coaster.
Exactly. Yeah. It would be no way near as special, as iconic, or as legendary as it is, flying around the blood waterfalls and the rock work and the bus that's got the machine gun that smokes on it.
Yes.
The music and the alien makes that roller coaster not Batman.
Yes. You know? Yeah, absolutely. No, I get that.
Definitely. And why Black Mamba's so special too, over there.
That's it, yeah, Fantasialand. Yeah, again, just the whole area, the theming, the sounds, everything just works together really well, doesn't it?
And that's where the industry's heading now more than ever. I think we're done with going bigger, faster, taller. I think we're now into people having more experiences with the storyline that they can connect to emotionally and have a moment with.
I see that, definitely, especially with the likes of Wicker Man.
Yes.
At Alton Towers as well. Again, not the tallest, not the fastest. Yes, the first bit of wood we've had in 20 years, but it's the theme. It's the story, the pre-show, which I love. Well, I think the pre-show is as good as the coaster, you know.
You know, in Croc Drop, the final ride I did for Chessington World of Adventures, you know, taking a standard drop tower and making it unique with a story and special effects and making a presence that it wasn't about going on the ride that was important. You know, being in the presence of that attraction with the smoke and the lighting and seeing people on the ride is as enjoyable than actually going on it itself, which is even more enjoyable for the whole family. And it was important to me that I created an attraction like that, because we were replacing a Topspin. Topspin
exactly.
is the ultimate theme park theatre. The ultimate. Yes. They are great fun to watch. They're great fun to watch the water. They're incredible. And that's why it was important that something like Croc Drop was designed to kind of be a
emulate that, really.
And be theatre and not just a ride.
Yes, definitely. Croc Drop's the perfect example there, actually, Andrew. And of course, you had a hand in creating that as well, definitely. Perfect. So, I mean, thank you for that answer. Let's move on to our next question. This one was on Twitter from Jess M1812. And this is what I love about this, is that there's going to be questions about you and how you've grown in the industry and what you've done, what you want to do in the future. But also there's people asking for advice as well, which is great. So she's asked about your route in the industry. I know we sort of touched on that in the last episode as well. But she's currently at uni and your job is her dream job. And she's basically just wanting a few tips and hints on how to get into that. I mean, I think I remember you saying before that there's no right or wrong answer as such. I think she's just intrigued on and how you managed to get into the industry and where you are today.
Hey, Jess, thanks for asking. This one comes up a lot. We're kind of... We've got a problem in England with this industry because, you know, in America, you've got all the opportunity over there because of the movie studios and everything that goes on. And, you know, quite recently, I've been doing a lot of work with students in America who are very interested to hear how Europe designs theme parks. You've got to remember over there, there's Universal and Disney, which are the theme parks. Then they have a lot of other parks there that are not. So you've got budgets of 3 billion compared to budgets which are, you know, 10, 5, 20 million.
Yeah.
So they're very fascinated to hear from people in the UK who are in our job. So the way I did it was, you know, I got up and lived and breathed it from the age of 12 to 14, really. And there was no other job that I was ever going to do. This was it. And I devoted my entire life to designing, understanding design and understanding the psychology of people. Yeah. So, you know, get out there, visit attractions, write reviews on them, but don't just write a review on an attraction. You know, everyone does that. Try to understand why the designers made the decisions they did. You know, what budget constraints were they facing? You know, why does that light flash at 1:20 and at 1:20 there's a sound effect that accompanies it? What's that kind of doing? Why would they do that? And then take that design and try and make it better. You know, try and look at that design and go, okay, well, if this was my creative decision in that room, actually, I don't think that's the right thing to do at that point to the audience. It would be better if we did X, Y, Z. You definitely pick up SketchUp. It's free. You can go on Trimble.com and you can use it on there and download it. There are so many tutorials on how to use SketchUp. Start building stuff in scale. Now, when I talk about scale, it's literally 1 meter, 2 meter, 3 meter, 4 meter. So a little tip for everyone, if you go to B&Q and you buy a standard off-the-shelf wood chip board, they come in 2440 millimeters by 1220 millimeters. All of the horror mazes I design and build are built using those dimensions of boards. Put it into SketchUp, start designing shows, start writing stories, start sketching, start getting out there. Now, to get your name out there, go and volunteer. Now, theatres are reopening again, so they're going to need volunteers more than ever. So volunteer at a theatre. Learn how the lighting decks work. Learn how the special effects are triggered. Learn why actors are being told to act in the certain way they are, or, you know, when a movie does something at a certain time, why it does that. It'll be worth going to watch my documentary I did on building insomnia on YouTube as well.
Definitely.
Because that goes into a lot of stuff about designing these mazes. Start with designing a small one, do a design book for it, then go and find a farm and tell them about it. See if you can sell it. That's how I built Slasher. The way that Slasher happened was I kind of got tired of waiting for that perfect job. It was never going to come. Mm-hmm. I'd been working in architecture up to that point for about 5 years, designing retail stores for High Street.
Right.
And I knew all of these things about architecture, interior design, disabled access, fire codes, all of these things. It just wasn't happening for me. So I sat down, and I'd been going to America for 3 years in a row, building horror houses over there with Jerry Jewell, who owns a company called Schooltronics out in Sacramento. Nice. And I thought, you know what? I've got the experience of how to build a horror maze from working there. I know how to control the lighting because I learned it there. And we were using a program, which is you can still get, called VSA by Brookshire Software, and Monkey Basic, which allows you to take the VSA programs, and when you press button one, it starts show one. When you press button two, it starts show two. When show two finishes, it goes back to show one. So you've got essentially a pre-show hold state for guests coming into a room, a pre-show state of room running that then goes back to pre-show hold state.
Sweet.
And VSA uses DMX, and DMX is a lighting language that theaters use to control lights. So if I have five LED lights that can go red, blue, green, RGB, I can then sync them in time to a soundtrack on this timeline using VSA. So I knew all how to do that. I designed Slasher. I met Ivor and Tom Robinson, who owns Screamfest, and I took Slasher along and I presented it to them, and they said, let's build it.
Wow.
And that's how it happened.
And that's how it happened.
That was my big break. That was my big break into the industry. In 2013, I opened up Soul Seekers and Nocturnal. And by 2014, I was designing and building Bolliger & Mabillard roller coasters in Italy called Oblivion the Black Hole.
And that's mad to think, you know, so that's a short space of time from 2013 to for Slasher with Screamfest to then designing, you know, the theming for coasters like around the world. That's insane. Do you sometimes have to pinch yourself, Andy?
The six and a half years I worked with Merlin were incredible. I was involved from the concept to creation of incredible things. You know, everything from creating four lands like Kung Fu Panda, Peppa Pig, roller coasters, being involved with roller coaster design and having Oblivion the Black Hole, the Gruffalo River Ride Adventure. And, you know, well, first of all, being challenged with taking the Bubble Works.
There's a whole episode on that, isn't there? Let's be honest.
Which the whole enthusiast community didn't not let me forget for that entire year of designing it.
That's a weight on some shoulders, actually, thinking about it, isn't it?
To have a very, very nice email from John Wardley who said how much he enjoyed it and how wonderful the Gruffalo is and I think it's now entertaining a whole new generation, where I'm having emails from the same generation that would have originally rode Bubble Works, had the same memories, are now having that on the Gruffalo. And I think that's the thing, you know, things advance all of the time. You know, we advance and we move on. Things have their day. It's okay to remember attractions like the Bubble Works in their heyday, but it was old. And, you know, we as theme park operators, you know, they don't run museums, and you need to make a decision. Do we want to be able to stay open for another five years, or do we refurbish an old ride just to keep people happy who, you know, would come anyway? You know, that's the business side of design. And it was a great run, and I created some great stuff, and in a very short period of time, onto different things.
Definitely. And now it's all about the future, and exciting things to come soon, I'm sure, as well. Now COVID's out the way, well, touch wood anyway, and getting it in the rearview mirror at least. But yeah, okay, awesome. Thank you for that, Andy. Really appreciate it. Let's move on to our next question. This is on Instagram from That Halloween Queen. So hello, That Halloween Queen. this is actually a question about scare acting. Lots of people within the industry have, you know, even creators and designers and owners will sometimes pop into a maze and have a little bit of an act or for a night and whatnot. Have you ever gone into to act in any of your attractions, or have you acted in any other attractions? Did you enjoy any scare acting if you did?
Thank you, that Halloween queen. And of course, darling, of course. If you type in Andy Porter slasher, you will see me in full glory as the original James Monroe, who was outside the attraction in 2012. That's me in full garb. I love it. I love getting involved. I don't think you can be a storyteller if you don't step in the shoes of who you're portraying. You know, to really understand the design of the maze, it was James Monroe's world for Slasher. And if you don't step in those shoes, then you're never going to get that connection between the audience and the character. So I've acted in many of them. In later years, I didn't, when it came to things like in Insomnia. But it's important as a designer to at least act in them or operate the roller coasters that we design, to understand what it's like to be staff.
Yes, I get that, definitely.
What I learned from working in the horror mazes was having that wonderful relationship with my actors, that we were all in this together. But understanding their problems of how difficult it is to work in those environments. I mean, these things stink. I mean, if you've, the amount of scent machines I've seen smashed and broken from angry actors
going, it stinks, isn't it?
Working in Love Hurts sewers, and the worst scene in Love Hurts is the long corridor with the fan at the end, because that's got this acid smell in there. And that stuff's grim. There was one night I had to drive home with all the windows in my car down, because unfortunately with the smell machines we use, they've got timers on them that go off every 7 minutes. Well, you don't know when that 7 minutes off. And to turn them off, you've got to literally pick them up, open them off, and then switch. And if you're new like I was to doing it, this thing was pointed right in my face.
And
of course, you know, the next day you come on site and you still stink of it. But
grim.
It will get you a seat on the tube, believe me. So putting yourself in that situation as an actor, as a designer, or as, you know, working on roller coasters, what's it like standing all day holding down okay buttons? You know, if we're designing stations like I did on Oblivion, where there was an event when the roller coaster vehicle leaves the station. So anyone that doesn't know, Oblivion, the Black Hole, is a floorless dive coaster. So that means the whole floor disappears when the station dispatches. So you've got to be able to design all of your station staff to be behind gates. Yes. So when they hold down the OK button and they've got their thumbs up and they press dispatch in this coaster station, and the floor goes down. Well, that floor doesn't know if anyone stood on it or not.
Right.
It just doesn't. So we have to design the stations in a safe working environment that's got gates, that when they are shut, it sends a signal to a computer system that, yes, the dispatch button is pressed, but also the gate is shut.
I see. Yeah.
All of these different things that kind of come in, and there was a laser system on it as well, if anyone came on the exit platform as well. But the point is when all of, as a designer, when all of your staff are in a okay position, safe position, and they press a button, I have now got about 30 seconds for the floor to disappear, and the roller coaster car not moved, by the way. The floor disappears, goes into its safe position. A signal goes to the control system saying, okay, floor's gone, check. Roller coaster can move, which then drives the drives wheel of the station, which pushes the roller coaster forward. So you've got about 30 to 40 seconds of dead space for those on the ride, and also those watching the ride to get in to do something cool with.
Yes.
If that's strobing the station, that's making smoke go off, that's making a really loud soundtrack go, you know, 3, 2, 1, point of no return, you know, don't look down, and all of the other wonderful stuff that we put in there, how much is that going to drive your staff crazy?
Yeah, good point. Good point. It looks good for the customer, but the staff hear it a million times a day.
There's only so many times you can press that on training day where you go, "Wow, this is great! I love my job. That's amazing." To the third day of all excited kids screaming when that floor disappears and the anxiety of knowing that the train's going to be dispatched and that smoke machine's going to go off again.
Yes,
and it's the same in horror environments. You know, they're really, really tricky environments to work in. Strobes, it's dark. But more importantly, you don't know how the general public are going to react.
Yes.
When you jump out and scare someone, they could punch you. They don't mean to. We deal with the people that do, but they generally don't mean to. So as a designer, I've got to design the spaces in a way, if someone's going to jump out, the audience kind of expects it. Now, that's either doing a long, dark section in pitch black with violins that are going, sort of noise that's going on, and then bang, flash, jump out, because they were expecting it to happen. Mm-hmm. Rather than from nowhere, which will get you a better scare, but will also put that actor in harm's way.
Yeah.
Now you can do it if you design the sets to have meshes where the actors are behind perspex. So if the guest punches the perspex, it's the perspex that takes the hit and not the guest, not the actor.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was. I love doing it, and I love putting myself in those situations, and love acting in there. I think it makes me a better designer for the guest and for my staff. You know?
Definitely. No, I get that. When I'm chatting to staff at my place of work, and my real job, in inverted commas, is I run a family entertainment centre, and some people are sometimes surprised to see me doing the jobs that all my members of staff would do. My cleaners, my cooks, my receptionists, my party hosts, my laser people, you know. But the more a manager, or in your case a designer, does the job of everyone who's going to be running the shop, basically, the better they can manage it, the better they can create it, the just make it a better scenario for everyone, you know, the designer, the people acting in it, such as scare actors in this instance, and then that only is it's only ever going to translate into the audience as well.
I think more importantly, if I'm expecting my actors to stay in a damp location for 3-4 hours because I designed it to be in there, I should know what that feels like myself.
Yeah,
to then be able to say, right, the people working in the cage area on Love Hurts, they need to be on 2-hour swap shifts. You know, if I'm going to use those water effects, if I can't keep the actors from getting wet, then, you know, it's uncomfortable. No one wants to be doing that all the time. And you're expecting them to stay positive and excited about what they're doing because they're there because they are passionate about acting. And you need to give them the stage and allow them to be able to do that too, as comfortably as possible within the environment.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. And we all know that scare acting is not an easy gig.
No.
It's really not, definitely. Awesome. So I hope that answers that your question, that Halloween Queen. Thank you. Moving on to... I've got some sort of mixing it up a little bit, some sort of more quick fire questions, and Jack sent a bunch of these in as well. So, and that's if you don't mind answering some of these as well. One of them is, who do you look up to or admire within the industry? And I think that's just the general entertainment history.
Candy Holland and John Wardley.
Two very good answers. I'll let you elaborate a little bit on them as well.
Oh, okay.
Just a little bit.
Candy Holland gave me my shot and hired me to do Oblivion. It was an absolute honour and privilege to work with her and learn everything that it was about designing a theme park space and more importantly, how to manage the teams when you're building a roller coaster.
Yeah.
It's not just a case of going, right, we're going to put this roller coaster in. It's a lot of work to make sure the choreography of the roller coaster is correct with the roller coaster manufacturer that matches our story that we want to tell. You are working with engineers. They are not creatives. It's a real important thing to understand. You know, engineers who build roller coasters are very intelligent people that understand physics and math. I don't understand physics and math. Math scares me.
numbers terrify me. In fact, I might make a maze about numbers. But when you work with engineers, you've got to understand that, you know, they don't care what color it is. They don't care that a smoke machine goes off. They don't care that strobe lights are happening in these areas. But it's my responsibility as the creative lead on that project, as she was the creative director, was to make sure that they were in place for us to be able to add our things to it. If we've just spent, you know, a lot of money creating a soundtrack where the roller coaster was set on a block break for 2 minutes, it better be on that block break for 2 minutes. And, you know, and so understanding how to manage those creative teams is incredibly important. So when the guests go there, they are getting the show that we want them to see. And she was a huge inspiration to me leading up to getting my job at Merlin. I'd followed her career, and her name's behind some incredible attractions from, you know, Hex 13, you know, you pretty much name it, you know, Swarm, in fact, every major roller coaster at Thorpe Park. So, you know, and then obviously John Wardley, and mainly John Wardley, because he spoke to us. Yeah. And I think that's really important. Yeah. And it's what I try to do. It's why I do these podcasts, and I try to be as honest as I possibly can without getting sued. John Wardley spoke to us. If you saw him in a theme park or you saw him doing something, he would stop and he would have time to talk to a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old about the job that he did and how he got there and how he got into it. Because at the time I was growing up, no one was. I wanted to get into this industry that was beautiful and incredible, but no one knew anyone who was in it. You know,
of course, yeah.
But he was there, and he was quite happy to come and talk to people and spend time doing that. And I appreciate people that take time out of their day to do that. And you know, that's what me and my business partner Michelle Hicks do a lot of. We believe in the next generation of creatives. It's why we've started up Firefly Creations. We hope that one day it's going to be a big company. And part of its company mantra, which it is today, is loving everyone's ideas and allowing everyone to have the chance to be who they want to be. As long as you're passionate, as long as you've got a love and you're willing to learn, and we're willing to talk to you and listen to you. But, you know, if you come along and I give you advice and you don't do it and then you just expect me to have another phone call with you, different conversation.
I had to work hard
for this. I expect you to do.
Absolutely. Hard work, dedication and passion. They're That's the it. Main things, aren't they?
Lots Definitely. Of tears and broken fingers from hammering wooden panels together at 3 a.m. or painting concrete walls.
Blood, sweaty tears. Definitely. Okay, and another awesome question here from Jack is, which attraction that you've worked on, and let's go scare attraction, because obviously theme parks and big coasters that you've been working with will obviously take longer than scares, but let's say we're talking about fear houses, which one took the longest to create from step one to step finished?
Insomnia was 2.5 years.
Wow.
Insomnia was actually 9 years. Really, I mean, if we're gonna be if we're gonna be really around about it, I research all the attractions that I build, and all of the things I learn from them get used in the next thing. So yeah. Slasher wasn't my first, but it was my first as AJP Design Terror Productions. And it had a throughput of 240 an hour, and I laugh about that now because it's just so funny. But at the time, that's all it needed to do, and quickly, because of how successful it was, it just couldn't deal. And so then we put another execution room on it and took it up to 440 or something like that. Again, it wasn't able to deal with it, so I loved the movie attractions. The attractions like Insomnia is a movie attraction. It's a full immersive, emotional journey that's powered by thought, whereas Freakout isn't. It's a generic terror house where you walk around it and there are clowns in there, but it had its purpose too. Yeah. And then it went to Nightbringer, where I used the idea and tried to make that work, and it was an operational, I don't want to use the word nightmare, but it was difficult to operate because of how complex it was. If you got it right, it was genius. But if you got it wrong, it kind of fell on its backside. So that was kind of the end of the movie attractions. I can't even remember when that one closed, but it took up until 2019 to use all of the theory I'd learned about attraction heartbeat, about audience psychology, about movement, about scripting, actor control, immersive entertainment of getting across my political agenda, which Insomnia was about your kids may be going through something, and as a parent, you probably should listen to them rather than blaming the television or blaming their friends or blaming an outside influence, because whatever they're going through, you're not listening to, which is what Insomnia was about, which I think everyone can relate to, which then makes it a good topic to turn into something, along with nightmares, which everyone has had with life anxiety. So it all came together, but still it was a 2.5 year process of designing each room and why each room should exist. Who is Crackerjack? Who is Tabitha? Who is Evelyn? And how do I, so the longest thing on Insomnia that took me to do, how do I get people not to be afraid of Tabitha? So just think about that.
Good point, actually.
Everyone
think
about
that
for a second. Everyone, you know, Mikey, take a think about why I would be concerned that people would be scared of Tabitha. Have a think.
Because she's in a scare maze.
And she's a creepy child.
And it's a, you know, yeah, creepy child in a scare maze. Because of her surroundings and because of what, people have bought a ticket to be scared, you're quite right. Yeah, you'd think instantly they see someone, they're going to go, there's a scary person.
And she's a child that's got a demon in her head. More importantly,
that helps as well.
If we're going to top line this, that's that, you know, okay, her eyes aren't glowing red just because I couldn't afford the contacts, but just... The problem I had was, how do I not make people afraid of Tabitha? And this all comes to the psychology of insomnia. I have to get people in that queue line to feel sympathy for Tabitha like their own daughter. I have to get the mothers and fathers who are coming through that attraction to see Tabitha look at the set. So the first set is a living room, which could be your living room in a normal street. Mm-hmm. It's got IKEA in there everywhere, and it's got, you know, the TVs in there, and it's got, you know, normal family life. There's toys, and you've got Tabitha in there, and she's drawing a picture of a white house with a red door and a red roof, which is the first scene. And there's a whole load of different podcasts of the again, watch the documentary of the psychology of why I did that. But she's talking to the audience and being really nice to them, like their own daughter, having fun with them. So then when they get to the next scene, which she's going to bed, the bedroom looks like their daughter's bedroom. It's got pictures on the walls. There's toys everywhere. The mum's putting the daughter to bed, who she can see is having problems with them. And then we've got this entity, this external entity, which no one believes this kid is having, interrupting that innocence of childhood. Mm-hmm. And my voice might start cracking here because of emotional connections to this attraction, but that's just because I care about the way it's scripted. So I'm going to try and get through this without sobbing. But the point is, you know, if you're making an emotional connection with someone and something, you have to drive the audience to think, what is my connection with these characters? That could be my child going through this thing, and I can't help her.
Yeah.
But I can help my kid. And that's the whole emotional thing that drives it, that took me so long to orchestrate in those bits in the queue line to create an emotional connection with that character. That's not the one you should be afraid of. It's everything else that you should be afraid of.
Absolutely. Definitely.
You know, which is what made it so difficult and why it took so long to write. And when you're trying to tell a story, we don't... This is the major thing about when we design theme parks and attractions. You know, we come up with these stories like Wicker Man, all these massive, big stuff with a lot of complex narrative in it. You know, we have to top line our stuff. We don't have a 3-hour movie to introduce people to Evelyn, to Tabitha, to Crackerjack, to all of these people in there, to the tribe around Wicker Man, all this stuff. We have got literally 30-40 seconds for people to go, I understand what's happening, right, I'm ready to experience it.
Yes. Yes.
And that's what was so hard with Insomnia. It's complex.
Well, I was going to say, it's another emotion that we're, the audience aren't necessarily used to, especially when it comes to a scare attraction, because we're used to, the two main ones are fear, being scared, jumping, and comedy, laughing at each other. But to have the compassion, the care, the thought process of like you say, not being scared of this child, but actually feeling sorry for this child and being compassionate, it's another type of emotion that doesn't always hit us. It wouldn't hit us if we were going through a through Slasher as such. No, you might feel sorry for him because he's going to die, but do you know what I mean? it's a very different level, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about the emotional connections I made on Slasher. It's quite interesting if maybe it's another thing that we can do where we can play the soundtrack and I can tell you why the queue line has got a 10-minute soundtrack with protests saying every soul can be saved, you know, and what was going on back in those times when I designed it, of politically what was happening.
I think that we've just figured out our third episode together, Andy. Winner, back. I like it.
We'll go back to Slasher and what I wanted to do and why I took such a risk on it and why it was so different. But that's another one for another time. But
yeah, definitely. So
he had his problems. He was bullied, massively bullied as a child, massively misunderstood as a human, and was cruelly treated by the world because of the learning difficulties and problems that he had.
Yeah,
and that moved into him trying to work out why people are so cruel to each other. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people know this, I've spoke about it, but actually James Monroe character, well, obviously I didn't go as far as he did, but it was me when I was 7, 8, and 9.
Mm.
You know, if you haven't noticed, I'm a little bit eccentric. I appreciate football, and that's as far as I'll go with it. I like the ballet, I like theatre, I like stories, I like theme parks, I like stuff that my friends in secondary school didn't or thought that was a certain character trait, shall we just say.
Yes, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and it was no, hard, you know, it was hard, hard for me to find my place, but, you know, me being open about this now will hopefully give other people the chance to be open about it, because if I'd followed their path, if I'd have followed the same path that they were going, I wouldn't be designing theme parks right now.
Exactly.
I can guarantee you that I learned to embrace my difficulties, my learning difficulties and my problems and my eccentricity, and you either like it or you don't.
Yeah, well, it's one of them, isn't it? Yeah, like you say, exactly that. You like it or you don't, but we embrace it. That's the best thing.
Good, I'm with friends.
Definitely. Definitely, because we're the same. My parents, bless them, they used to call me an anorak when I was a kid, because when we'd go to our yearly trip to Horton Towers for my birthday, I'd go, so this is Air, it was built in 2002, it cost £12 million, it was designed by John Wardley, they put in this little corkscrew bit here because they were losing corkscrew because that's left, do you know what I mean? And they were like, okay, you're anorak. And then I'll tell friends at work now as a 32-year-old male, I'll go, oh yeah, I'm chatting to Andy Porter, he designed this and he designed that, and the way he did this was because of it was a storytelling thing. And don't get me wrong, people that listen to the podcast, they love it, which is why I do this podcast. But my friends at work look at me and go, what is that, like a Halloween house? And like, no, there's so much more to it, but hey-ho. It's who you surround yourself with, isn't it? I don't choose who I surround myself with at work, but I do here on the podcast. Lovely, friendly, scary people.
There we go. That's amazing.
let's hit another sort of quick fire-ish. I know it's difficult because I want to hear the answer, but then I want to go, ooh, yeah, tell us why.
I know, these aren't working out as quick fires, if I'm honest.
I know, right?
Let's carry on.
Let's carry on, definitely. Right, next, what's been, and again I'm gonna make this into the scare side of things, because I'm sure you subcategorize, but what's been your favorite project to work on? Now I'm sure, obviously, you know, working on the Oblivion but Black Hole was amazing for, you know, the roller coaster enthusiast in you who loved Oblivion back in 1998, but if we're thinking of scare track, thinking of fear parks, what's your absolute favorite?
Sorry, who's this from?
This is from Jack as well.
Oh, Jack.
Jack Blesser has sent in loads of questions. So I'm doing a selection of Jack's.
I'm going to do a very Andy thing. And okay. I'm going to dismiss your request and answer it how I want to.
I like it. Go ahead.
This is an interesting thing. There is no difference between designing a terror house and designing a multi-million pound roller coaster. Okay. I think I need to make that, you know, quite clear.
Yeah,
you know, we are talking about orchestrating an audience on a certain topic. Mm-hmm. So Oblivion, the black hole at Gardaland, has got, anyone who hasn't been there, it's got a very eccentric queue line, to say the least on it. It's got a full soundtrack. It's a training facility with touchscreen interactives. There's 3D projection mapping in there. There's water effects. There's even a scare bit in there where you put your head in a hole and an air jet hits you in the face. Nice. To prepare you for all the things and all the wonderful sights that you're going to see on as you drop into the black hole. Mm-hmm. The way that's orchestrated and designed was for a family audience. There's no difference between the design thought on that and, say, Hillbilly Joe, or which is the more comedy light one, or even, I mean, we could even go as far to say Freak Out.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're orchestrating sort of emotions of excitement, of anticipation, of exploration of what's around the next bend. You know, what's going on around there, or you know, what am I going to see? Or I can't wait to go through that door because I don't know what's happening. So the music on Oblivion, the black hole, there's 12 soundtracks for it, which is not uncommon for me to use because Insomnia's got 24.
Wow.
And it starts with a very simple light violin beat of dun 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 dun, and that's how you start the training academy, with this woman voiceover going, "Welcome to the Oblivion Training Academy. You are going to experience effects in here to prepare you to drop into the black hole."
Right.
And when you get halfway through the training facility, we add more beat into there. We add the drums of dun 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 dun.
Nice.
As you go round that corner before you then see the roller coaster again, dun 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 dun, and then you go up onto the bridge, and as you walk across the bridge, all comes together with the orchestra violins to reach the station platform, which comes to the massive big bit when that button is pressed. 3, 2, 1, bam 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 bam. You know, it's really sort of building it up and really building that anticipation and excitement. And it's the same as the soundtrack in Freak Out, which starts very friendly, very light, dun 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 dun, sort of, you know, really nice stuff to reach the end, which has got this heavy metal evil clown of, you know, it's insane in there. Because we're driving an emotional narrative. And the emotional narrative on Oblivion, the black hole at Gardaland, was that anyone can do this ride. It was the absolute opposite to the one that was in Alton Towers, which is very sinister, very full on. This one at Gardaland was, you can do this. You are brave enough to do this. We are going to train you. We are going to inspire you. We are going to uplift you with this feeling that you can sit on this roller coaster and achieve something brilliant.
Nice.
And it works.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
It really does work. And that's the same when we look at the, you know, everything from the Gruffalo, which has got the same heartbeat theory in there. You should never let an attraction flatline. It's got to have its dark areas. It's got to have its light areas. It's got to have its moments of surprise. It's got to have its moments of relaxation. You have to reset the scare heartbeat whenever you're doing an attraction. It's no coincidence in the Gruffalo how it starts with in the dark, and then the lights come on with the mouse on the log going wee, you know, and then the sun rises. It's a bit dark in the next scene, but the next scene after that, it's full daytime and it's so bright and it's wonderful. So now I've got the confidence of the very young target audience that are going on it, that they're comfortable, they're engaged. Yeah. Nothing's going to jump out and scare them in here. I feel comfortable for us to go into the snake scene, which is very dark for a long period of time. But we've promised them the lights are going to come back on, so they're not scared, they're engaged, to go Gruffalo around that corner with the giant Gruffalo going ho ho ho. It's a heartbeat of an attraction that you, as the creative choreographer, you've got to write them in. Now, just because in a scare maze, that heartbeat may be a little bit more intense and a little bit more full on for a different audience, you don't patronize your audience just because they're three, because the adults are going on it too. And that's, you know, I can't remember what the original question was, but that's my answer.
No, I like it. I like it. It makes sense. It makes perfect sense. It just goes to show how you basically can just not just use the same methods, the same heartbeat, the same sort of ideologies for totally different style of attractions. And like you say, it's all about not looking down on your audience, isn't it? Not looking down because they are 3 years old. Still, you put the same effort, the same detail, the same design, the same heartbeat, as you put it, into a attraction that's the Gruffalo for you know, aimed at small children compared to something that's for adults like Insomnia or Love Hurts.
And I think the point is while a 3-year-old will enjoy the Gruffalo, so will a 12 or 13-year-old. And I didn't remove the fountains.
Or 32-year-old. I love it. I love the Ruffalo.
I didn't remove the fountains. So what of those people that said I was going to? Nah.
The fountains are still there. Nice. Perfect. Right, we've got another question here from Robert Spink. So, Robert, thank you very much. This is kind of similar to one earlier, they've sort of added more to it as well. He goes, what advice would you give for someone who is trying to break out as a creative set design prop maker? So similar to the question earlier, say, how do you break into that sort of role? They said that they keep inquiring, but keep getting the lack of experience as the answer to why they're not really getting anywhere. And that's from Robert. So again, would you just say sort of create your own experiences and sort of push that to people?
Yeah, thanks, Robert, for reaching out. It is a problem. It is a frustrating problem. I've been there. I was there for 4 or 5 years, the best, if you want to go into building props and making props, start building them. Yeah. You know, film yourself doing it. Start a YouTube channel. You know, get a bit of an audience going on it. Stage some things. You know, you could go out into the public and you could create a prop of a clown in a little box that shakes, and then you could create some sort of live theatre out of it. So go to your local Amdram group, find some crazy actors that are interested on doing some sort of TikTok, YouTube thing, and, you know, create and build the prop. No, do the designs for it. Again, SketchUp is great for prop design too, because it will give you those dimensions. Build it, do it, film it working, and then you own the sort of creativity of building that sort of prop in that world. That's one thing that you could do off the top of my head. The second thing is go to the farm parks. You know, if you're being told by all of the large manufacturers who design and build props, don't stop talking to them. By no means, never stop talking to people and getting out there saying who you want to be. If a job comes up that you see that you don't have experience for, apply for it anyway. Let people know who you are, and you won't go away until they hire you. And go to the farm parks and volunteer your time set painting and set building for the Halloween events. It will force you to be creative with the materials that you're using. And then when you've built those props, you know, talk to the owners, because you've done that, to watch people in your scenes and interact with those props. Are they working are they working the way that you thought they were working? Are they getting the reactions that you thought they were going to get? Or are they just being lost into the background as traditional set dress?
Yeah, you know, was this prop meant to do something that everyone saw, but only 20% of the audience are seeing it? Mm-hmm. Because then that changes you from just being someone that designs and builds props into someone that understands the theory and the practical application of why props exist in those places. It makes you far more valuable than just someone that gets an order to do stuff. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I get that. Definitely, definitely. And thank you for the advice there as well, because that's definitely going to help him out. It'll help other people out. I've got a perfect example of that sort of thing as well. A good friend of the show, Jake Jones, he just started loving creating, as we've been discussing, creating props and horror masks and things like that. And you mentioned Talk to the Farm Parks. It's the independents that are kind of your way in, aren't
yes.
they? And that's what we're lucky with in the UK. We're a small country, a small collection of countries, but there is quite a handful now, and there's only more and more each year, of independent scare attractions or independent haunters, whatever you want to call them. A friend of ours, Jake, he just liked creating these horror props like knives and axes and anything with blood on, really, and masks. And he got to talking to the guys at Scream Camp and The Retreat and The Ritual, and they now use only his props and nothing else. And they created the small independent movie, which is now on Amazon Prime, and his props are in that movie. So again, it's a similar sort of thing. Just as Andy, you were saying, it's the independents, it's the farm parks, it's let them know that you're there, and you know, create your own sort of like you say, make it, paint it, build it, because then that's how experience builds, I guess.
Yeah, and you know, and also you don't just have to think, oh, it's only the scare industry. Remember that only runs for 1 month a year. You know, if you're wanting to make a job out of this, you know, we've all got bills and mortgages to pay, you know, and you know, so, but there's also a lot of escape rooms that open up in the country now. They always need new props. Their stuff's getting damaged all of the time.
True,
you know,
true.
So there's escape rooms everywhere. There's Christmas, there's pop-up experiences like the secret cinemas. You know, these, you know, you know, we've got the movie studio, Leaveston. I don't know if you've tried talking to those guys or if you're just totally focused on the theme park industry. You know, the movie industry in the UK, they're opening more studios up at Pinewood. I don't know where you live in the country, obviously. I mean, that can be tricky. But there's lots of opportunity everywhere now to do what you want to do. And okay, maybe designing Christmas props isn't exactly what you wanted to do, but it's a start to get you that experience, and in your free time you can be doing the Halloween stuff at the same time. Just make sure that anyone in this industry don't stereotype yourself into one little box, because if you want to be professional and make money out of it, you're going to need to have your hand in lots of different boxes. Don't become the horror guy. Don't become this guy. You know, you look at my career. Yes, I started out in horror, and probably in the UK, I'm probably most known for it. But every single attraction and project I did it while working for Merlin was not horror. I did no horror work at Merlin at all. You know, Peppa Pig, Kung Fu Panda, Gruffalo, Room on the Broom, all of those things. And the point is, I guess it's easier for me because my passion is entertaining people. I want to make the world a better place through themed entertainment. That is what I do. And, you know, I'm very fortunate to be here, but I've worked hard for it.
Of course,
it's
absolutely
not easy.
Yeah, no, definitely. No. And once you got there, it's still hard. You know, things like COVID screw things up, and it's always a continued fight, isn't it, Andy?
Well, we established Firefly Creations in March 2020.
You couldn't have picked a worse month, could you?
I don't do anything easy, but no, it was, you know, it's been a struggle. But you know, in that struggle we've met some incredible people. We've had incredible conversations with people that we probably might not have done if COVID wasn't here. My life was going to go in a totally different direction, which I can't say too much, that if you know, COVID wasn't around. And I think, you know,
that's life. It throws things at you, and all we can do is make the best decisions with what we've got at that time.
Yeah.
And try and do the best we can, but try and be kind to people at the same time. I mean, that's the big thing. It, you know, business doesn't have to be gritty.
No, I get that. Definitely. And that's a breath of fresh air here in that as well, because although I love this industry, I love this, I love the theme parks, the screen parks, the theatres, all that sort of stuff, you know, the entertainment industry, I love it. But I see it from a spectator's point of view a lot of the time. You know, the little family entertainment centre I run is kind of out of that little bubble, but I know it can get gritty and a bit nasty and a bit dramatized and a bit aggressive, and so it's a breath of fresh air of you and Firefly just saying, look, let's do business, but let's also be kind to each other, which I think is the perfect message, especially after the year we've all had.
Just have some fun, you know. We're all on this rock together. And
absolutely,
we're not getting off it anytime soon, so we're kind of stuck with each other. So
definitely,
try and make it fun.
Try and make it nice. Speaking of nice and fun, I've got one last question here from Paul Young over on Twitter. So thank you, Paul. And this one, I think we sort of touched on it a little bit when you were discussing on how you design your attractions, especially when quoting the Gruffalo and how it goes dark and then bright and then dark and then bright. But he's put on our Twitter feed, and he's talked about it before, but please ask him about his approach to creating rides and worlds for children and how a story can play a part in them building confidence. He said he's heard this answer before, that it was very interesting, but I think he wants you to share it with us as well.
I hope I can remember what I said. Hey, Paul. Great to hear from you. Thanks for your question. Yes. So let me just get that in my head. Right. So basically, let's go back to the start of this session, which is turning into War and Peace right now. let's go back to the beginning when I said about analyzing people, creating stories, and looking at the world that we live in. What's that person doing over there? What's in that sewer? What's behind that tree? What's in that rabbit hole? You know, if I go into that rabbit hole, what world's going to be down there for me? Then let's try and look at children's attractions, because there's an interesting thing about when it comes to psychology, when it comes to fear.
Yes.
Fear is a taught behavior.
Mm-hmm.
It's a taught behavior that you could argue is in our instinct, if we're flight or fright creatures when we were as cavemen, and nighttime we couldn't see, so there's all these saber-toothed tigers running around, so we're naturally afraid of the dark because we can't see what's going on. Okay, we could argue that everyone's afraid of the dark because of the unknown that lies within it. So that is kind of understandable, inherited behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
Then when we come to other fears, like spiders and clowns, and the reason why I say spiders and clowns, because I'm terrified of spiders and clowns, and the reason I'm terrified of spiders and clowns is because my mother is terrified of spiders and clowns. And there was a time we went to American Adventure, that wonderful, wonderful place. American Adventure, fun for the family. I'm not going to sing the theme song, or I really want to. there was a clown, and he took my mum by the hand and took her across the road and left her over there.
Right.
My brother and my dad were laughing. I was absolutely traumatized by this.
Oh, bless you.
This quite horrendous looking person that, you know, at the age, I was just, you've got to imagine what that was like. And, you know, my grandma was afraid of them as well. And then I had another traumatic situation with the clown with my grandma in a circus, although she, you know, she did give him what for. I don't indulge in India. I don't support the behavior, but that's the kind of woman she was. She was very protective. And spiders are just horrible. I mean, they're just... And That is taught behavior. That's taught fear.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you end up having conversations about designing dark rides, you normally get into the same meetings where you're dealing with parents who are on the design thing. That's too scary. That's going to terrify my child. And funny enough, this came up when I looked at Toon Blaster, when one of my final projects I did in 2020, when we redid the lighting and audio in Toon Blaster.
Right, yeah.
About
yeah.
how scary it was going to be. And I said, the kids aren't going to be scared of this. The adults are going to be scared of it, because the kids are going to be so amazed with this age group of how engaging and fun this thing is.
Mm-hmm.
They don't process fear in the way that adults do. When we reach a certain age, we realize how mortal we are and things start to hurt. I can't do Nemesis as much as I used to anymore.
100%.
You develop fear as you get older, you know, when you start paying taxes and you start paying bills and, you know, things start to get very adulting. So we've got to remember as designers that kids aren't there yet. We are creating a fantasy world for children to exist in, and more importantly, to develop in. We are creating worlds of play. We are creating worlds of discovery and exploration.
Mm-hmm.
We are trying to harness an environment where adults can feel comfortable to be children again. It's very difficult if you create an attraction where the very first scene is where parents and children have to dance together. The parents just aren't going to... I'm not going to do a flat-out statement like that. Let's just say 70 to 80% of the parents are going to feel really uncomfortable doing it because they feel silly.
Definitely.
If we put that scene 30, 40% into the attraction, once we've done a little bit of silliness, we've had a little bit of fun, we've put a few adult jokes in there. You watch Peppa Pig properly and the script is hilarious because it's written for adults as well as it is for kids. And it's genius the way that they've tied all that together. But it's the same in anything we watch with innuendos that they get put into there. But if you create an atmosphere of play where the adults feel comfortable to play at the same time, they start engaging with their children in ways that they normally wouldn't, because the environment doesn't feel safe for them to do so.
Yeah.
So now we've just built confidence within that family unit where it's okay for us to play. Yeah. Now we are creating emotions and narratives where parents aren't instilling fear into their children, but they're instilling feels of happy memories and play. And that time when we went to this thing and we did X, and how much confident that gave me seeing my mum or dad be silly, because it told me it was okay for me to be silly rather than... Nice. Me as an adult to be serious all the time, where I can't relate to them anymore. And then we end up with a situation like I wrote in Insomnia, where the kids can't talk to their parents because we can't break down that line of you are old, I am young, you don't get it.
Now,
obviously I've jumped from a 3-year-old all the way through 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, maybe even up to 21 there.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
the point is the environment that we instill is the thing that teaches our kids at a young age that they develop into the future. So when we design an attraction for children, we've got to look at how not to patronize the older audience, how to engage them where they don't feel silly and, oh my God, this is like really, really childish and I really don't want to be in here, but more of, oh, aren't we having a great time in here? Wasn't that funny? Oh, that elephant's just squirted water at me, or that hedgehog's just let off gas in my general direction. That's funny. And it did it on the older sister who's laughing, which the younger sister is laughing, and that creates that moment together. Then what we're doing is we are then saying that these rides, if we then talk about instilling confidence on going on Vampire or Nemesis or Oblivion, you know, that is a whole different level of psychology, but it kind of borns into here. I'm a child that's very worried to go on the Gruffalo because of XYZ. I'm in the station. Oh, I can hear the birds. I can see the trees and, oh, it's all wonderful. Right. I've now sat on the ride and I feel okay.
Yeah.
And I feel okay because I'm on the ride and now we're going through and all of this world of wonders around. And that, when they get off the ride, they have a level of confidence because I did it. I went on the dragon roller coaster. I went on the Gruffalo. I went on this. I went on the vampire with my dad, with my sister, my mother. And that creates a level of confidence and pride that you did something that your friends at school would go, wow, I can't believe you did that. You're so brave, which then makes you feel good. And it's a positive emotion, which is why theme parks exist and which is why I love my job.
That is a perfect answer. If there is one, that is a perfect answer. Also, oh, Andy, thank you so much for that. That was not only just that question there, and I'm very glad that we were prompted to ask you that one as well. But this whole hour and a bit, I think everyone who sent in questions have got exactly what they needed out of it. Everyone listening to this episode who's obviously a fan of scare attractions, theme parks, a fan of your work personally, I think this has been great. And we've all learnt loads again, which is fantastic. So thank you.
You're welcome. And this is where you say to me the record button wasn't pressed.
Thank goodness it was.
Thank you, Mikey. It's always a pleasure.
Absolutely.
Everyone definitely out there, visit theme parks, enjoy yourselves, create memories, and be kind to one another.
Absolutely. Perfect way to end this episode. Andrew Porter, a huge, huge thank you for joining us on ScareTrack again. And we'll chat to you when we talk all about Slasher next.
Can't wait.
Cheers, buddy. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to ScareTrack.
So there we go, folks. First of all, a huge, huge thank you to Andrew Porter for coming back onto the ScareTrack podcast. Really, really do appreciate it. He was happy to answer literally any questions that we threw at him. So I really appreciate how open he was and how much knowledge and feedback and general just advice that he can give us. It really, really does mean a lot, especially in our industry as well. And someone of Andrew's caliber, he's created fantastic scare attractions that we all know and love, very different styles of scare attractions too, along with some amazing theme park experiences. You know, Croc Drop is an absolute hit for Chessington this year, and he's, you know, a handful many more as well. Very excited about what's happening in the future with Firefly Creations too, and very excited, speaking of the future, to chat to Andy all about Slasher. There's lots of history with that attraction, so I'm very much excited to sit down and have a good hour's chat about Slasher as well. If you guys have enjoyed this episode and this is the first one you've ever listened to, then a huge thank you for joining us here over at ScareTrack. Be sure to click that subscribe button wherever you're listening. You can also get us direct on our website at scaretrack.co.uk. On there you can find all the links to our merch site, all our social media pages. We're on Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat and Facebook. Of course, our YouTube channel as well, youtube.com/ScareTrack, for all our video content as well. And we really just appreciate you listening, watching, supporting, liking, following, absolutely anything for ScareTrack to help us make the rest of the world listen to how good the UK scare industry really and truly is. So on that, it's a huge thank you to Andrew once again for coming to join us on the ScareTrack podcast. A huge thank you to you guys for listening, and let's get scared. See you later, folks.